The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Centre Parks. Enjoy family time like no other.
Now, my next guest is a Michelin star chef with his restaurant Anir, which means from the West, in Galway's West End. He is an author and his latest book is called An Alphabet of Anir, Notes for a New Irish Cuisine. And he is culinary director of Eat Galway, JP McMahon. Busy man, good morning.
Hey, brother, how are you?
How are you? You're in our Galway studio. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Good, good, good.
Congratulations on the book. Now, before we dive into the book, which I spent a good evening with last night, it's a great little dip in and dip out, so congratulations. Tell people who may not know about Anir, about the restaurant, please.
So Anir is 12 years old this year, and it began as a project to see what type of restaurant you could do if you limited yourself to the ingredients that that exist in Ireland. I suppose that's what it is in a nutshell.
Wonderful. And the book reflects that, the book that's come out now, which is your second book.
Yeah, very much so. I wrote a bigger book, The Irish Cookbook, which dealt with like the entire history of Irish food over 10,000 years with 500 recipes. But this one is more of a, as I said, a reading book. There's a few recipes, but there is a disclaimer on the website. So this is not a recipe book.
Okay.
I use the form of the alphabet to talk about all the different things that we do in the restaurant, like foraging or using seaweed or wild game or many, many different things about Irish food history that people may not know, because when you ask someone about what is Irish cuisine, it is a difficult question because of the legacy of the famine and colonialism.
Of course, and I until I picked up your book, I hadn't heard the phrase Irish cuisine, so it's wonderful that you're owning that as well. Just to say as well, Anir, you also run a boutique cookery school, correct?
I do, and we do 6 to 8 people usually one Sunday a month, and then we run a 6-week class on Monday nights. And that started at the very beginning of the restaurant to try and we weren't so busy,
yeah,
because we were doing adventurous things like not using lemons or pepper or all those things, and people were serving steaks and people were a bit wary of us. So we set up a little cooking school, and thankfully the restaurant is going well, and as you say, it retained its Michelin star this year. But we set up a cookery school that is also it's to educate people not only about Irish food but about cooking in general
and about what you do, because that is quite a fascinating thing, to limit yourself not to use lemon or black pepper in cooking. And I like that cooking is, I know as much about cooking as I do about football, so you're going to lead me on this. But was it a good idea to not use lemon and black pepper, and how did that work for you? Was it awkward?
Like, it was very difficult to begin with, and it's not something like I limit myself at home, so it's not like I'm some sort of crazy purist that I say these things cannot be used. It's more about, like, we wanted to see what would happen, and we were very influenced. I'm sure many listeners know the restaurant Noma in Copenhagen, and they about 2005 began this type of thinking, that saying what would happen if we limited ourselves. And what it does is it makes you more creative, because if you have to find, like, lemon gives acidity, which is a really, really important component in building a dish, so you have to find other types of acidity, and then you go look at different vinegars like cider vinegar, and then you start making vinegars, and we make a seaweed vinegar for our oyster dish now. And like, it did take a while. I mean, ironically, black pepper you can live without. It has nothing to do with salt. Many people confuse salt and pepper because the French put them together, but salt is essential for living. Pepper is not.
That's very interesting. What I'm kind of getting, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong, is that in a way is if you were landlocked on an island and you can only access the natural goods that are near you, this is the kind of cooking you're thinking about. Is that correct?
Yeah, 100%. And I'm very interested in Irish history. And if you go back pre-potato, so about 1600, like, there was a lot of oats, buttermilk, wild food, wild game, seaweed, shellfish, all of these things. And we have all these things. And I suppose we just, perhaps don't appreciate them as much because we live in a global world. So the restaurant is like a little oasis to kind of step outside time and just to go in and say, oh, this is interesting. We have an oyster dish with seaweed. And to taste it. And sometimes I'm interested in trying to capture tastes that we might have forgotten, because when we're so used to seasoning in a contemporary way, you can put some spice on it, you can put, like, you can go in your own house, you can make a Mexican dish, even though we're thousands of miles from Mexico. And it's just a little reprieve from that to think about what would happen if there was no other, we had no access to stuff from around the world.
I love telling people this. My great grandmother was a fishmonger, and my grandmother was taken out of school at 6 years of age because she was good with maths, to tell people who she owed money to. So we grew up on shellfish, and actually seaweed is delicious. Like, I really like seaweed, especially if it's kind of fried and stuff. So I loved reading your book. But we'll get into seafood in a minute. You did, this is a quote from you. We didn't serve potatoes, and there was nearly a riot.
At the beginning, we have a tasting menu now, but at the beginning we just did a la carte, and we said, look, we're not going to serve potatoes on the side. And there was literally, people were like, where are the spuds? And we were like, oh, you don't need them. And they were like, we do need them. And what we found over 2 years was that people were using the spuds as a safety net, like the spuds that you get in the middle, and we just end up throwing out so many of them. So we went cold turkey, I remember, one Christmas, and we said, we're done. And we forgot to tell, my brother Alex was managing at the time, and we forgot to tell him, and so he went, opened the hot drawer and went, where are the potatoes? And we said, oh, we didn't do any tonight. And he was like, the customers are looking for potatoes. And I said, you're going to have to tell them we're done. And we do have potato dishes on occasion, but we are, as an island, addicted to potatoes. But what's interesting is we're a net importer of potatoes now, and so we don't grow as many potatoes as we used to. And a lot of people see them as kind of central to Irish cuisine, but I mean, I think they're a kind of peripheral new ingredient. If you think about, people have been in Ireland 10,000 years, and the potatoes been here 400. So they are a relatively new ingredient.
So if you have, you know, visitors to the area, sort of people might go to restaurants, they could be looking for steak and spuds and those kind of things, right? Do you ever feel the pressure to give them what they want, or do you ask them to leave?
Occasionally, and sometimes when we get a really nice piece of beef, we do use Dexter beef on occasion. And it's a native cow that is a lot smaller.
Yeah.
And we usually serve it as tartare, but sometimes you do put it like a steak on, but it wouldn't be like your steak and chips if you were coming in looking for it. But I think that by and large now, and actually we were closed over the pandemic, but the pandemic actually helped us to a certain degree, in the sense that pre-pandemic, most of our customers were American. We would do 80% American tourists. Wow. Looking for a kind of new Irish cuisine. And during the summer of the staycation, we had so many people from all around Ireland come to an ear, because they couldn't travel, and they all thought we were new, and we were there 10 years, and they were saying, oh, this is really interesting, are you new? And so I'm still really always surprised when people come into the restaurant, particularly local people, and say, oh, I've never been in here before. And I'm going, well, that's wonderful, because it's just a little like a little chamber to think about what food would look like. Now, there are two ingredients, because someone will ring you and say, we don't produce sugar in Ireland anymore, and that is absolutely correct. And okay, we don't produce white flour, so they're two exceptions we make,
right?
Just because, as you can run a restaurant without black pepper and potatoes, but you cannot run a restaurant without sugar. It's very difficult, particularly when you get to the desserts.
We were talking about the deer in the park earlier, where I spend a lot of time up at the Phoenix Park, and I presume you serve Irish venison. Is it wild or farmed?
It's wild. There's actually, to my knowledge, there is only one venison farm, and it's up in Northern Ireland. We would get our venison from County Clare, and some people like the deers and they're cute. But like, we serve rabbit as well, and that's like we don't eat enough rabbit in Ireland. There are literally, tens of thousands of rabbits all over the country,
okay,
and we're all eating chicken every day because chickens aren't cute, and that's the difficulty. Like we put little human features on these animals, but like eating rabbit and venison is really sustainable, because deer breed so rapidly. Like a couple of hundred deer can turn into thousands in a number of years. And so the deer are culled very carefully, and Eamon Gilbin, our hunter, supplies us with venison and also pigeon, pheasant, partridge. And I didn't grow up with these game birds. I grew up in Maynooth, like eating Rice Krispies and Cocoa Pops. And it wasn't until I became a chef that I realised we have this long heritage. Like, the wild duck has been in Ireland 10,000 years. So it's like, if you want to think about what people were eating 10,000 years ago, like oysters and wild duck would be a good place to start.
So when people now have discovered you internationally and locally, they want to experience something new and different when they come to you. Do you find your customers more open-minded now?
Yeah, no, very much so. And we've got to the point now where we just do a very long tasting menu. We do a 22 course tasting menu. Now, some of the courses are very small, so that's like, don't fall over. It takes about 3 hours, but some of them are really small. Like, we just build up these little things and you eat them in one or two bites. And we started, as I say, a normal restaurant. We started with a la carte, yes, start a main course dessert, and it took us 12 years to get to this point. And it is just a way of trying to bring people on a little journey through time in terms of Irish food. And like, it's an experience, yeah. And I think we're €140, so it's not, I don't like the elitism that comes with expensive menus, and I'm very much interested in trying to feed people and to get them educated. So for me, it's like, it's a treat. It's people come once a year, you know, but it is like going to the theatre or going to the opera. Like, it's something, yeah, that you can take away with you.
I love a tasting menu experience. Once you set yourself up for it, don't eat for the day, feet under the table and get nice and comfortable, and you just chat. You don't even have to think, the food just comes. So I'm well in, but I've never heard of 22 courses. I'm fascinated by that.
I think I'm going to stop there. It was 18, and then I was like, oh, should we just put another two? And see, there's always new ingredients, and I'm going, how do we get that in? I was like, oh, just add another two. And but the experience is getting longer and longer, and like three and a half hours is like, I don't want it to turn into a kind of 5 hour
sleepover.
Yes. So because people as well want, I suppose, also they don't want to be sitting down for a very, very long time either. So I find three goes at a good pace, yeah. And that's I think that's our limit.
And I think the fact that you've gone to 22 courses and you're saying there's so many local beautiful ingredients, so wild food is abundant, you're saying, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's really, like, I mean, wild garlic is available at the moment, and it's probably the most popular one. And of course, like, if you're going out into the woods and picking wild garlic, be careful, make sure you do your homework, maybe bring it back and ask someone. But it's there, you can pick it sustainably, in the sense of, you usually take about a third. They say you take a third, leave a third for nature, and then a third for the following year. That's the same with seaweed. You always think in terms of thirds. You take a third for yourself and leave the other two thirds. And like, it's just a wonderful taste that really captures the season, because wild garlic has a short window of about 6 to 8 weeks, and it transforms in the flowers and the seeds, and like, we get different things from it. But it's just a great way to experience. So if you pick some wild garlic and make a little wild garlic pesto, you put it in your fridge, like, in 3 months' time, you cannot buy wild garlic. And that's what I love about wild food. Like, you pick it and then you use it or you preserve it, but it's part of your larder then. And then if your friend's coming over, it's something unique that you can't just pop down to the supermarket and buy.
So that's a great tip. A third, a third, a third. Just pick a third, leave a third. Do you go foraging yourself?
I do still. I try and bring the kids, but they're 14, 11 now, and they just think I'm crazy. I dropped my daughter up to it when she started school, and there was loads of rowan trees. And she said, if you come near this school and take these berries. I said, there's loads of them. No one's taking them. And she's like, you're a crazy man. And if I see you on the school grounds picking berries. So, and she's like, get out of that person's garden. I was like, there's just some flowers that they don't, they're wild.
I think you're amazing.
We don't, because nasturtiums as well. Nasturtiums are a great plant, and people grow them for ornamental, but you can eat the leaf, the pepper, and the flower. There's really peppery. And sometimes, like, when I see a massive one and it's kind of on the outside of someone's garden, I was like, we'll just pick a few flowers. And she was like, oh my god, you're so embarrassing.
So that's a particularly easy one to pick. What else is easy to pick when you go foraging for people?
The elderflower is going to come up soon, and that's really, really distinct, and it just grows on the trees. You can make elderflower lemonade, you can pickle elderflowers. It goes really well with them. With fish. I mentioned the wild garlic. I mean, in the autumn, you've got to have blackberries. Everybody knows what a blackberry is. Mm-hmm. You can pick blackberries. Dandelions, even though nobody likes them, there is not, I think there's 300 varieties of dandelions. Wow. And you can eat them all. So you cannot do yourself any harm with a dandelion. I mean, mushrooms are a different ball game, and I'm still very careful with mushrooms, because I'm not a mushroom expert, and I know a few, but you always have to be very, very careful with mushrooms. But seaweed, you can knock yourself out.
Yeah.
You get little sea lettuce if you wander down by the beach, and it's really great if people like, I mean, you mentioned running, and I do a bit as well, but if you're going out for a run into nature, like, it's really nice to start to slow down and just to start look, because there are thousands of herbs and plants. And you look at one, you bring it back, you Google and you see what's in season. There's some great websites, Wild Irish Flowers, to help you identify. And then a Pranny Radican has a little book on seaweed that you can put in your back pocket and then go down to the beach and just, it's also something you can do with
the kids as
well.
You've just literally triggered a memory. I remember the car on the Sunday drives and my dad pulling over the side of the road because he'd see a blackberry bush. Mm. Everybody out! And we'd all be standing at the side of a road risking death to pick blackberries and he'd make jam. So we were foraging before we even knew it was called
absolutely.
Foraging.
Yeah. And it's elderberries are another one. And it's just, look, it's not, foraging is not going to like transform your life into like you're going to be able to just go home and never go to the supermarket again. I'm not that type of forager. I think it's a really great vehicle to just re-engage with your local landscape and to see what, and then when you find a bush, like a blackberry bush or an elderflower tree, and then you can go back to it every year. I mean, cherry blossoms are edible as well. The Japanese love cherry blossoms and they'll be flowering in May, and you can make vinegar, you can make a kind of sugar syrup that you can use to make a cherry blossom drink. So there's loads and loads of different stuff that we just don't know that's there.
So I got a funny text in here. It says, please ask JP, foams, why?
Well, like foams, the reason why restaurants like foams and people, I suppose, like eating them is that when you aerate a sauce, the taste buds on your tongue taste it better because there's air in it. And so generally, even when you're, even before, if you have a soup, if you're serving soup at home and if you blend it and just lift the blender up and foam it, the people will enjoy the soup more because the flavour of the soup will, I suppose, coat the whole sense of their tongue. So that's, do you know, the first person who whipped cream was creating a foam. I know they're kind of overused, but when you put air into something, you can taste it better.
There's another text here, D in Dublin. I only eat fish and lots of veg. I always feel I can't go to a tasting menu, but I'd love to. Can you give her some advice on stepping into the tasting menu world?
I would just say to the restaurant, I only eat fish and vegetables, and they should take it. And if you don't, well, then I'd give out to them. But no, do you know, I used to have this kind of cranky chef attitude, saying, "No, what we do is what we do." And then, do you know what? I just said, you know what, I'm going to just whatever people want. So we do a vegan tasting menu, vegetarian tasting menu, if you want only shellfish. I've yet to have someone come in and say, I only want meat. So I did have people come in and say, we don't eat vegetables. So there's some Irish people, I don't know how they sustain themselves. And I was like, which ones? And they said, all of them. And I was like, all right. So the vegan menu is very challenging because when you limit yourself, you don't want to repeat yourself. But at the same time, we really enjoy doing it now, and it actually makes us more creative because, I mean, it is very easy to take a piece of meat and cook it and put a bit of sauce with it, or it's easier. When you cook with vegetables and then if you exclude dairy, it gets much harder to create the same taste sensation. And that's why I struggled for a while because I didn't want to give someone something that was just vegetables. And I said, that's not the equivalent of what we're doing. So now we're kind of happy with that. So absolutely. And I think in my mind, restaurants should be open to feeding people now if they want something vegetarian or vegan. I think we're gone with the days when you get a portobello mushroom the vegetarian option was just you remove the meat and you just gave them the
vegetables.
I have
two friends who are vegan celiacs. It's actually a nightmare going anywhere with them. Like, forget about Italian. But
absolutely. We can take them.
You can take vegan celiacs. I'm on my way.
Very
good. Fuck us in. You're reminding me of that urban myth about the person who asked for salt and pepper in a posh restaurant and the chef walked out of the kitchen and ordered them out of the restaurant.
Some chefs get very upset when customers season their food because they see that as their function. It's like if you ask the carpenter for his hammer because he said you didn't finish your thing properly. But certainly I do think when the next time you're in a restaurant and someone asks, do you want salt or pepper? You say, I need the salt, but why do I want the pepper? And pepper has a long history, a long crazy history, and it was seen as the king of the spices. And I do love it, like in context. I love it on a carbonara or different stuff. But when you sprinkle pepper on everything, it changes the way the food tastes, whereas salt amplifies the food and it makes the food louder. So salt is really important, but pepper is less important.
Oh, brilliant. Okay, let's talk about the book, An Alphabet of an Ear, Notes for a New Irish Cuisine. So on the front, interestingly, you have a sea urchin. And then I flicked straight to the sea urchin with buttermilk and tarragon recipe. Sea urchins, controversial?
I don't know. When I put it in there, people are like, do we even have sea urchins around? Like, we had so many sea urchins in Ireland, and typical, I think, like the gas, we said, sure, we don't eat them, we might as well give them away. So we invited the French and the Spanish and the Italians in, and seemingly, this is before I was born, in the 1970s, yeah. Down in Cork and Galway, trucks would arrive and just hoover up the sea urchins and bring them all back to Europe, because the Europeans love them. Now, we do have, like, there's a sea urchin farm in the west of Ireland, Mungo Murphy, they're trying to kind of repopulate and grow these little sea urchins. They also grow sea cucumbers and abalone, which are another side. But I don't know, I find sea urchins just really amazing, because you open them up and they have these little gonads and you eat them and they're really creamy. And then we put it with buttermilk, because I was just thinking you couldn't get any more. I know it sounds absolutely daft to put buttermilk, pour buttermilk into your sea urchins, but buttermilk is very acidic, and it acts as the lemon. It's like putting the lemon on your oyster.
So yeah, it says sea urchin with buttermilk and tarragon, and the method is to open the sea urchin with a sharp scissors, cut the sea urchin open by inserting the scissors into its mouth, cut it in a circular fashion, and be careful not to damage the gonads. What does it taste like? What would you compare it to?
God, you know, it's a little bit like the roe of a scallop, but more, much more creamy and a little bit more delicate. I mean, the Japanese absolutely love them. They sell them they just take out all the little gonads. They're like the little tongues. And they sell them in boxes, and they go for crazy prices. And we don't really eat them at all in Ireland.
So I mean, it's like a kind of a scallop. And are they? You're cooking them. You're heating them, right?
No. You eat them raw.
You just
open it up. Yeah. I mean, you can put them in sauces and that, but no, they're much better eaten raw, because they're so small and delicate. Occasionally, if you go into a fishmonger's, depending on the season, I know the Galway Market, Gannet fishmongers will have them when they're in season, and it's just a really fun thing to try. They're very spiky, so you kind of have to
be
a little bit careful. And they do move. It's kind of crazy if you put them on the table. They move with their spikes. So if you put them on the table, they do look a bit like an alien.
But their
mouth looks like a little bird's beak. I know they're strange. They're the weirdest looking creature ever.
Wow. So listen, talk about the book. It's actually in its conformity, it's abstract. It's alphabetical. And yes. The first is academic, acidity, alcohol, exot, almond, alphabet, anear, apples. So explain to people how the book works, because I flicked through and I really enjoyed it, I have to be honest.
Yeah, it's a lovely book to, I think, just to open in the middle and find a letter, like, say, you could say M, and then you could look up mushrooms or Mount Sandal. I don't know if any listeners know Mount Sandal in Derry, and it's the oldest known habitation or the old place of that people lived in Ireland about 8,000 years ago. And
wow.
They have found like hazelnuts, burnt hazelnuts, and some sea bass and salmon. And then you can look up, I don't know, L, and I talk about the relationship between literature and food. Also talk about love, because sometimes we forget about when you cook, you need to love what you're doing, because sometimes if you don't, then it doesn't taste very nice. And it just goes through loads of different ideas that we have discovered over the years. Seaweeds, there's lots of different seaweeds mentioned, lots of different wild sea herbs like sea beet. And it's just a little window into a world that exists in Ireland that you may not know exists.
And you know what? It's a great gift for the food lover in your life as well. It's called An Alphabet of Anear: Notes for a New Irish Cuisine. JP McMahon, you have demystified cooking and food for me already. Thank you so much for taking our call this morning. And best of luck with the book. Thank you so much.
Cheers.
Let's take a quick break.